All right, so we're ready for lesson 11 in Proverbs. We're still in the My Son Wisdom and Folly Discourses. This is part 8, and today we're going to cover chapter 6. There are 35, I believe, verses to this chapter. So I'd like to read them all. My son, if you become surety for your friend, if you've shaken hands in pledge for a stranger, you are snared by the words of your mouth. You are taken by the words of your mouth. So do this, my son, and deliver yourself. For you have come into the hand of your friend. Go and humble yourself. Plead with your friend. Give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Which, having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. A worthless person, a wicked man, walks with a perverse mouth. He winks with his eyes. He shuffles his feet. He points with his fingers. Perversity is in his heart. He devises evil continually. He sows discord. Therefore his calamity shall come suddenly. Suddenly he shall be broken without remedy. These six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. My son, keep your father's command, and do not forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually upon your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you roam, they will lead you. When you sleep, they will keep you. And when you awake, they will speak with you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. For by means of a harlot a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. Can a man take fire to his bosom, and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? So is he who goes in to his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent. People do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is starving. Yet when he is found, he must restore sevenfold. He may have to give up all the substance of his house. Whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He who does so destroys his own soul. Wounds and dishonor he will get, and his reproach will not be wiped away. For jealousy is a husband's fury, therefore he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will accept no recompense, nor will he be appeased, though you give him many gifts. Well, there are four complete sections to this chapter of Proverbs, and I divided the fourth one into two pieces simply to fit all the verses on the slide. And we've got the first time that we've encountered this many distinct topics within one chapter. Normally the chapter has one topic and one theme, and you work your way through it and get the understanding. Here, I think there is still a prevailing theme, but it covers multiple topics. It's beginning to look a little more scattered, like the verses from chapter 10 onward, where they appear to be random. I don't think that's the case, but it's clear that there are different sections in here. So this first section of Proverbs 6, 1 through 5, describes a condition called surety, if you've become surety for your friend. And surety is something that we might not hear much about by that word, but it's still something that's widely practiced today. So here's a short and simple explanation of the concept of surety. It's the promise of a third party to assume responsibility for the debts or obligations of another in the event the debt cannot be repaid or the obligation cannot be performed. So it's the idea of a third party taking responsibility for a debt or an obligation on behalf of someone else. Modern instances of surety still include this idea, but is often transacted in much more complex ways. So, for instance, surety in the construction industry, surety is widely used in idea of surety bonds. So if you are a contractor on a job and you are subcontracting work to be done, you might be required to hold a surety bond so that the work of your subcontractors, to make sure they get paid and to make sure that the people for whom you're doing the job have some recourse if your subs cannot perform. That's a common way. There's an entire business of underwriting surety bonds, and that's a common way that takes place. Another instance of surety in our society that may not seem like surety at first glance, but it certainly is, are federally guaranteed student loans. So I don't remember the names of the loan structures that are available at Oklahoma State, for instance, and other colleges, but if you have a federally guaranteed student loan, you're still borrowing money from a private lender, but the federal government has assured that lender that if you were to default on that loan, then they would take over the payments for it. So those are two general instances of surety that are still widely practiced, although no one really thinks of them in the biblical form of surety. Today, our forms of surety are, let me rephrase that. I think the idea of surety in mind in Proverbs 6, 1 through 5 is more of an individual to individual, not institution to institution. So it's a matter of co-signing a loan for someone or securing some of your own collateral for a loan on behalf of someone else. And I think the idea contained in Proverbs 6 is limited in its scope to these personal guarantees or providing physical collateral on behalf of someone else. So what does Proverbs have to say about the concept of surety? So keep in mind, I'm not referring to the institutionalized forms of surety that are common throughout society. So I'm not commenting on the Miller Act, a federal act basically requiring surety. We're not referring to federally guaranteed student loans. That's outside the scope of what we're going to consider. We're only looking at these personal forms of surety because I think that's the idea that's in mind. Surety bonds, I'm sure, were not something that existed in 1000 BC. So if you co-sign a loan for somebody or you offer some property that you have as collateral for another loan, maybe an investment you have or an account you have or physical property in some other form, and you're offering that on behalf of someone who's borrowing money, then that's what we're referring to. Now, you might ask, for instance, why is it that we even have surety? Why would surety be required or be requested? So you come to the lender and say, I need to borrow a sum of money for a project or whatever the case might be, and the lender looks at your financial portfolio and he says, I'm not so sure you've got the ability to repay this, and I'm not so confident that the asset that you're securing with this loan, the thing that you want to buy, or that you're purchasing rather, not securing, is worth what you think it is. So I need some additional collateral. Well, maybe if you have two houses, you put up your second house as security for that loan. But if you don't have any other collateral and you still need to buy whatever it is you're going to buy, a house, a vehicle, or whatever it is, or a student loan, then you go to someone else and you say, hey, would you offer your house as collateral for my loan? We're friends and I'm good for it. I'm going to repay all this and I need, but the bank won't loan me any money without it. That's the scenario the lender is not going to provide you the funds until you get more collateral. You don't have it, and so you try to convince somebody else to provide theirs. These forms of personal surety are really interesting. They're condemned in wholesale in the book of Proverbs. Now, bear in mind, this isn't part of the law, as we might find mandates given in Deuteronomy or Leviticus or something. These are Proverbs. But you can see from this brief view, surety is the word we translate surety is used in different circumstances. It's translated differently, but in Proverbs 11, he who is surety for a stranger will suffer, but one who hates being surety is secure. Might even be a little play on the words that surety is security for someone else, but if you don't provide security for someone else, you're secure. Proverbs 14:10, the heart knows its own bitterness, and a stranger does not share its joy. It's this idea of association behind it. We're not speaking of surety there, but we are speaking of this, showing how the word is used. A man devoid of understanding shakes hands in a pledge and becomes surety for his friend. So here it's the man who doesn't have any understanding. So you get the idea, Proverbs 20 here, he who goes about as a talebearer reveals secret, therefore do not associate, do not meddle, do not intermingle. It's the same word that we translate otherwise as surety. And Proverbs 22, do not be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge, one of those who is surety for debts. Why? Because you'll reveal yourself to be a man devoid of understanding. I couldn't find any positive pictures of surety within Proverbs. Proverbs has this wholesale condemnation of the idea of pledging yourself. And in part, Solomon's description of this in verses 2 and 3 is that this is a snare. And that this is a trap, you're going to be taken, which is a common metaphor that he uses. We saw this even in the opening chapter, chapter 1. And it continues that when you think of surety, don't look at your friend and your friendship. Don't look at your friend asking you and hearkening you back to how you've been best friends for life and that if you could only help him out. Don't look for the bait, look for the trap. And he describes this idea of pledging yourself as being taken in a snare. So when you pledge yourself, the idea is that you are now bound in the hand of your friend because you, if he defaults, he takes you down as well. The lender doesn't care about your relationship. The lender doesn't care if the person getting additional security is your friend or a stranger. All he cares about is whether he's going to get his money. Your relationship with your friend or your relationship with the stranger is entirely your own business. But the lender, when he comes, he doesn't have mercy. It's not about friendship. He's coming because he wants his money back. And Solomon's warning that when you enter a relationship like this, you're putting your friendship on the line, for one thing, but you're also whatever form the relationship takes is online, but also you're pledging yourself based on the actions of someone else, someone that you don't control or you don't have influence over. So you don't know what he's going to do in the future with the money he's been given. And if he doesn't do what he says he's going to do, well, now you're going to be in serious trouble. So he describes, he describes this idea of being snared. And he says, if you find yourself in a trap, what would you do? Now, if you've ever seen a bird in a trap, they don't just sit there and say, well, I hope I can, let me plan an escape. No, they flutter about, they try to escape, they do everything they can. And there's a sense of urgency in verses 3 and 4 and 5. Deliver yourself. You've come into the hand of your friend. So start with humility. Humble yourself. Plead with your friend. In fact, don't even give sleep to your eyes. And this idea of sleep and slumber, I want you to think about as we move through this chapter. It comes up several times. Don't allow sleep to come to your eyes. It's so urgent. Even if it's late at night, it's time to go to bed. Go to your friend. Go to the lender. Find out if you can escape from this particular trap that's been set. So you have are now in the hand of a fowler. Earlier, you were in the hand of your friend. And he sort of ups the stakes a little bit in verse 5, and like a bird in the hand of a fowler, a professional, you're caught. You're probably not going to get out of this, so you need to do everything you can right at the onset to escape what you foolishly obliged yourself to do. So is it wrong to embark upon surety? Well, I don't think it is. I don't think it's institutionally wrong. But I think under most circumstances it is. But I think there are probably some exceptions that would allow you to practice surety. One of those might be you're perfectly willing to lose whatever it is that's being requested of you as security. It doesn't matter. I've got this amount of money, and I want to help so-and-so, and I'm perfectly willing to underwrite this venture, and I'm willing to let it all go. It's a risk I'm willing to take. In that circumstance, you're taking the posture of someone who's deliberately calculating the value of what you're embarking upon. I think what Solomon has in mind is the idea of being foolishly captured. You were impressed by your friend to do this, you signed, and now you realize, wow, I've been caught in a trap. Off I go. Well, let's move on. We have a lot to cover today. Verses 6 through 11 is the second section. So there are four here, but the second section is a chapter on indolence. I think indolence is a good word. I don't think idleness quite captures the same as indolence does here. So indolence, and I'm taking it to mean the avoidance of activity or exertion, a form of laziness. I think people can be idle without being indolent, but if you're indolent, you're almost certainly idle. So the indolent are told, it's interesting, they're not told to go to God's word, and neither was the man who pledged himself as surety, but he's told to go to the ant. He said, go look at nature, go look at the ant and see what they do. What would you find if you studied these ants? Well, I don't want to spend much time on this, but I was reminded while thinking about this that this idea of the way ants order themselves is an interesting idea to academics. And what Solomon has observed is that the organization of ants is a bottom-up venture. It's something that doesn't take place versus the top-down. They don't have a captain, they don't have an overseer, they don't have a ruler. And yet they're able to perform lots of different complex tasks. So Deborah Gordon of Stanford has a book called Ants at Work, which was quoted in an interview a few years ago, back in 2007, on a podcast named Econ Talking. And there's a paragraph here that's interesting. She says, the basic mystery about ant colonies is that there is no management. A functioning organization with no one in charge is so unlike the way humans operate as to be virtually inconceivable. There's not a central control. No insect issues commands to another or instructs it to do things a certain way. No individual is aware what must be done to complete any colony task. Each ant scratches and prods in its way through the tiny world of immediate surroundings. Ants meet each other, separate, and go about their business. Somehow these small events create a pattern that drives the coordinated behavior of colonies. Gordon then goes on to describe during the interview that what puzzled her about this phenomena is that 6,000 years ago or so, I think she was off a bit, somebody realized that this took place among ant colonies and recorded it where? Well, in the Book of Proverbs. And so she began part of her work, her academic career, on trying to determine what it is about these characteristics that Solomon observed these many years. Now, the idea is not some sort of Hayekian, bottom-up, self-organizing. That's not the idea that Solomon has in mind. But what he does have in mind is that, look, you've got this ant. He doesn't have any overseer. He doesn't even have a boss. And he gets up and goes to work every day. He gets up and performs his ant task and gets the whole thing accomplished. They're able to determine somehow that they have a future need and that future need needs to be met with work done today, work that needs to be performed. how they anticipate all this, I don't think Solomon understood. I don't think Deborah Gordon understands. I don't think anybody understands yet just how ants know to do these things, but it's clear that they do know to do these things. And I think the picture that Solomon has in mind is, one, that if you're indolent, you're not even as bright as an ant. He's saying, hey, look, dummy, ants are smarter than you are. Surely you've got this figured out. I mean, look at them. What are you doing? You're only asking for one thing, a little something, right? A little sleep. All you need is a little more slumber. A little folding of the hands. I'll get to that later. But right now, I just want a little sleep, right? That's the picture. Little, three times. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands. And what happens? Poverty comes upon you suddenly, like a prowler, and you're in need like an armed man. So this idea of being overwhelmed with poverty and with need, it's not as if poverty comes with this overwhelming force. It's not a band of robbers that comes in and attacks you. But you're growing in poverty until at some point you've become so inert, so functionally useless, that you have nothing. You have no resource left to provide for yourself. And now the hardship of poverty has hit you, and it's like you're being robbed. You're being prevailed upon by these armed men, by these prowlers. They appear to come suddenly because you weren't looking. You weren't looking ahead like the ants look ahead to anticipate the need so that you could make a provision for it. Instead, you just stood around, and this is what happened. Now, this idea of indolence is a common theme, just as surety was, there were verses. This idea of the lazy man is vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes. So is the lazy man to those who send him. If you've ever hired somebody who's lazy, this proverb, I hope, brings to mind what it's like when you task someone with a job. The lazy person, they can't get anything done. The soul of a lazy man desires, and he has nothing. It's the soul of the diligent that are made rich. Proverbs 19, a lazy man buries his hand in a bowl and will not so much as bring it to his mouth again. I mean, that. How lazy is that? You finally made it to the bowl, right? But you don't even have the strength to take your hand out and feed yourself. So you can see a list of verses. There are more. The lazy man says, a lion outside. I should be slain in the streets if I were to embark upon that. Okay, there's a lion outside. Yeah, there are probably other animals too, right? There's a lot of reasons. And what it says about this lazy man is that there is no reason which is too preposterous to keep me from being busy. Believe me, there's trouble out there. There's trouble everywhere you look. And the description of this lazy man is, it's interesting that he's not pictured as somebody who's stupid in the sense that he doesn't know he should take his hand out of the bowl to eat, right? He's a man devoid of understanding. That's the way Proverbs describes this lazy man, is he's devoid of understanding. He's not even smart enough to observe what the ants are doing, even when someone explains it to him. He can't see it. Proverbs 24, I went by the field of the lazy and by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding. That's the parallelism that we see in Proverbs. There's a synonymous relationship there. The lazy is the guy who is devoid of understanding. And here, Solomon is using his words again in verse 33. It's a little sleep, it's a little slumber, a little folding of the hands. And what happens? He's quoting back from chapter 6. But the difference between this guy, in verse 32, he says, when I saw it, I considered it well, I looked on it, and received instruction. That's the contrast. And that's what Solomon wants. Remember, Solomon always wants you to see the contrast about these paths that people are on. And the path of the lazy, the path of the indolent, is such that he's devoid of understanding. He doesn't see how this is going to work out. He doesn't see the poverty coming. He doesn't see the armed man which is about to overtake him. So he's been instructed as to what to do, and he's still devoid of understanding. But I saw it, and I considered it well. I thought about it, And I received instruction. There's the portrait of the wise man, the man who's in the opposite end of the spectrum. So in Proverbs 26, again, we find that for some reason there must have been some residual threat of lions in Solomon's day, because this lazy man said, there's a lion out there, just as he does in chapter 22. No, it's a fierce lion. So he's careful about the kind of lion he's willing to engage. I'd go out there if it was just your garden variety lion. I mean, trust me, I'm not who you think I am. I'll be out there for a mere lion, but not for a fierce lion. And so this guy, he buries his hand in the bowl. It wearies him. It's the same idea coming back. But here, attached to this, is this lazy man is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. It's the contrast. Solomon is mocking this guy. He is mocking a person who has this picture in mind of how they should live their life. And when he brings it to a close here in verse 16, he said, you know, the real problem is not that he can imagine there are lions. It's that the real problem is this guy thinks he's being wise. He thinks he's doing the right thing. In fact, if you were to line up seven men known for their wisdom, this guy says, you know, I see things that these seven guys don't see. I see the potential of fierce lions. Right? And that's the mocking that Solomon has for the indolent. Proverbs is never, ever soft on the indolent. Proverbs is pretty fierce with it. But even in the New Testament, indolence is something that's condemned. In 2 Thessalonians 3, for when we were with you, we commanded you this. Paul's instructing them, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Paul's very clear. It's not a proverb. It's not written like a proverb. It's a command. That's what he says. I commanded you this way. If a guy is unwilling to even go through some effort, now, it needs to be effort commensurate with his ability, right? We don't want to take somebody who's so used to being lazy and then put him in charge of a nuclear reactor, right? I mean, that's not the problem here. The problem is that he's wise in his own eyes. He didn't see the need. It's wrong to help people, to provide for them, if they are unwilling to begin the process of providing for themselves. Now, that doesn't mean when there's a tsunami that comes through and it wipes out that we shouldn't bring food and water. That's not the case. Charity is not being absolved here. Paul's saying, when you get to know these people, when you get to see that his problem is not lack of skills, he's devoid of instruction, it's wrong to feed these people. Ephesians 4:28, the idea of let him who stole steal no longer, let him labor, working with his hands for what is good. And that's really helpful. Take the thief and rehabilitate him to put him to work. For what end? Well, for the end of work, right? He needs to learn to work to build value instead of taking things from people, taking other people's value. He needs to create value. But it needs to go further than that. The goal behind work is that you have enough value that you can give to others. That's the idea behind it. So indolence, whether you're a recovering thief or you're part of the fearful of the lion crowd, Paul says the answer to these things is to be profitably at work, laying up for yourself provisions, both for today and for the time when it will come and you have great need of it. So, only a little. The sluggard, the slothful there, they only ask for a little. And that's why, in a sense, it doesn't really pay to listen to their excuses, right? So when they say there's a lion out there, you're not going to convince them there's no lion, correct? I mean, there's always, theoretically, the possibility of a lion, isn't there? I mean, if a lion escaped from the zoo, right? You never know. I mean, why take the chance? You're not going to convince him. It's not a problem of probabilities. It's not a question of saying, well, when was the last time you saw a lion around here? Well, there's always a first now, isn't there? Right? You're not going to argue with this guy. And the reasons he gives are pretty useless. The lion is one. But what does he see as his great need? A little something. All he wants from you is to be left alone for a little bit. He's perfectly willing to go to work sometime in the future. But right now, it's just a little sleep is what I need. A little slumber, just a little folding of the hands to rest. Once I get that, I'll be okay. You see, he won't be okay. There won't be anything that will ever satisfy him until the sharp, painful awakening of poverty hits him. And it comes on him like an armed man. And in all likelihood, he'll just see himself as a victim at that point. But that's what will finally awaken him. All right. I'm not going to go through verse by verse through 12 to 19. 12 to 19 is the first time we see a list given, and we see two lists given here. So verses 12 to 13, 12 through 14, he describes six different deceitful actions or activities involving the body. He's got a perverse mouth. He winks with his eyes. He's shuffling with his feet here. Perversity is in his heart. He's devising evil continually. He's sowing discord among the brethren. And the second list is the first time we find there are six things the Lord hates. Yea, there are seven that are abominable to him. And this idea, I think, of numbering these lists is maybe a helpful mnemonic for memorization. I mean, that was the goal here. Proverbs was meant to be memorized. And I think the idea, oh, remember, there's six. No, there's seven. It's just a device. I don't think there's anything magical or insightful necessarily about the number. But here he has a proud look, a lying tongue. You see the one who sows discord among the brethren, sort of linked back to this sixth item in verse 14. So what to make of these lists? I find it difficult to draw relationships between the list. I looked at them, and I don't understand what hands that shed innocent blood, what does that relate to? Is it shuffling the feet? Is it winking with the eyes? I don't know. I don't see a one-to-one correlation. And the commentator, Zockler, he characterizes these two lists in this way, which I found to be helpful. He said, the six or seven vices, twice enumerated in different order and form of expression, against which the paragraph of Proverbs 6, 12 through 19 warns, are at the same time all of them manifestations of hatred against one's neighbor. Yet it is not so much a general unkindness as rather an unkindness consisting and displaying itself in falseness and malice that is emphasized as their common element. So the idea behind these two lists is to show that God hates this activity. This isn't somebody who got snubbed in an invitation. This sort of person is maliciously acting toward his neighbor. And God is issuing the strongest possible warnings in verses 15 and 16, which are not displayed up here. So there are lots of ways these judgments are characterized, both in Proverbs and without. Job, I found a bunch in Proverbs, Psalm 35, Isaiah 1, Jeremiah 19, all use this language about the sudden calamity that comes upon the people who participate in this maliciousness toward their neighbor. Now, William Arnott, a commentator on Proverbs, this is a nice devotional commentary. I haven't quoted from him a lot, but he finds that there's a parallel in mind, and he goes so far as to suggest that Jesus actually has Proverbs 6 in mind in the Sermon on the Mount. So in 6:17, we have a proud look. And Arnett says, notice that Jesus is speaking of the opposite in his blessedness. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. In 6:19, he who sows discord among the brethren is in opposition to blessed are the peacemakers, for they are called sons of God. Arnett writes, there is one parallel well worthy of notice between the seven cursed things here and the seven blessed things in the fifth chapter of Matthew. In the Old Testament, the things are set down in a sterner form of what the Lord hates, like the thou shalt not of the Decalogue. In the New Testament, the form is in accordance with the gentleness of Christ. There we learn the good things that are blessed, and are left to gather thence the opposite evils that are cursed. But making allowance for the difference in form, the first and last of the seven are identical in the two lists. The Lord hates a proud look is precisely equivalent to blessed are the poor in spirit. And he that sows discord among the brethren is the exact converse of the peacemaker. The coincidence must be designed. When Jesus was teaching his disciples on the mount, he seems to have had in view the similar instruction that Solomon had formerly delivered. And while the teaching is substantially new, there is much of allusion to the ancient scripture as to make it manifest that the great teacher kept his eye upon the prophets and sanctioned all their testimony. So while not describing it as a direct quotation from the book of Proverbs, he's nonetheless saying that there's an unmistakable similarity in outline here, allowing for the differences in form and expression. I mean, we are talking about a thousand years difference in time and mannerisms of speaking, that he sees something there. I didn't, but now that I've thought about it for a while, I think there's something to it. I think perhaps we should leave it to the English literature folk to help us gather these things, because I can't see it at first glance, but I think they're far more capable than I am in understanding this. But he sees a relationship. So the last section starts in verse 20 and goes to 35, and it's the warnings against adultery. And back up here, the verse 20, we find, so let me back up here. Verse 1 opens with, "My son," okay? 6 does not. In fact, he calls him a sluggard. In 12, he simply starts describing wickedness. But in 20, he goes back to "my son." And not only does he go back to "my son," but he goes back to the pattern that he's outlined. "My son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother." Previously, we might hear things like, "incline your ear to me," or "lend me your understanding," something along those lines, usually attached with the giving of a command and hearing and "my son." That's the pattern that we've seen most commonly. I'm not sure why Solomon structured chapter 6 this way, where he only begins the instruction to heed a command, "here to keep and do not forsake." We've seen both it's stated both positively and negatively. But in particular, a number of commentators thought it quite important that Solomon is reasserting parental authority, and in particular taking notice about the mother's authority. So the word used for the father's command is simply the command of the father, the instruction, not the lesson given, but the command itself. I'm coming at a loss of words, but I want you to do A, B, and C. I want you to get that done. It can be taken that way. And the law of your mother, that's the word Torah. We've seen this before, and it's often described as the law, and in several cases, the law of your mother. And the idea that several commentators seem to think was important was to be reminded that we have, children have need of parents. That's universally understood. I think everybody realizes that parents are a good thing to have for kids. But specifically, children need parental authority. They need the commands of their father. They need the commands of their mother, teaching them in the place of God what God's law requires of them. And Solomon is in part reiterating the importance of commands. So I'm not going to go through verse by verse. There's much of it that's similar, but I do want to highlight a couple of points that I hope will help tie the chapter together. In verse 22, we find Solomon's describing when you roam. He doesn't use walk here. He uses roam. They will lead you. When they sleep, they will keep you. When you awake, they will speak with you. He's described previously the sleeping before, hasn't he? He's described that the sleep of the sluggard, for instance, and the sleep of those who have pledged surety is not a peaceful sleep. It's not a keeping sleep. But here he's describing that the keeping of the command will give you good sleep. And when you walk about, they'll be the things that keep you. The commandments are life. And in verse 23, we find this idea of reproofs being introduced. Although that's our translators using that word. A correction is another way of putting it. The commandment, it's a lamp. and the law of light. So there's repetition telling us it's illuminating things before us, right? And the reproofs of instruction, or the corrections of instruction, are the way of life. This is how God's word is portrayed to us. It's a way of life. It gives us life. How? By changing the course that we're on. We think we're on the right course. God's light, God's word, illumines our path in such a way to show us that, no, we're not on the right course. And we get this reproof, or we get this correction, and we get put on the right course again. So this same idea of reproof is back in chapter 5, verse 12, when the young man realized what he had done in the sexual encounter he had with the strange woman. His description was, how I hated instruction. It's the same word being given here, how I hated this correction. So in verse 24 and 25, we find it's the same woman. It's one of her sisters, I guess. This woman is married. We ran into the adulteress earlier. The last chapter was simply the strange woman. She was simply promiscuous. We don't know if she was married or not. And we find that Solomon is warning his son that the flattering tongue, you remember in the last chapter, her tongue did what? What did her tongue do? You guys remember what? Or from her mouth, rather, not her tongue.
Dripped honey.
It dripped honey, that's right. That was the depiction. And he said, look, she's got this flattering tongue. You're not going to believe what she's going to tell you. Well, you will believe. That's the problem. It's really, don't believe it. Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyes. When she looks at you, don't fall for it. Don't fall for it. And how do you resist all of this? How do you stop it? Well, you get down to verse 26. He says, you know, by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. This language of being ensnared and entrapped, it's the language of the bird and the fowler, that she is preying on you. That's the message. The woman that just seems so delightful, that you can't wait to be with, is preying on you. You're the victim. You're not the one that's being smart and wise here. You're the one, the hapless victim. That's what's happening here. In verses 27 to 29, we've got this idea of, can a man take fire to his bosom and his clothes not be burned? This is, in 520, the idea of being embraced in the arms of a seductress. It's the same word being translated, but there it was being taken into her arms. And now the picture is, what's coming into your bosom? What are you holding on your lap at this point? It's fire is what it is. It's fire. And I think there's probably a certain play on words in terms of the idea of a heated passion sexually. I think he's probably making an allusion here that you think you can take this heat and bring it to your bosom and not get burned by it? I mean, you're thinking one fire, but it's a different kind of fire. This fire burns, and you're walking on hot coals. How stupid is that? Do you think you're going to walk away unseared by the physical relationship with this woman? Whoever goes in the neighbor's wife, whoever touches her, he isn't innocent. When it comes to thieving, if a guy has to pay back sevenfold, which is not the biblical requirement, but he's just throwing out a large number. Look, the guy who was stealing because he was hungry, yeah, he'll have to repay. But everybody understands it. Nobody hates him for it. They understand he got caught in a pinch, right? He was hungry. But for you, you're a crust of bread. The thief, he has to go find seven of something to repay. But for you, all the gifts that you give aren't enough to repay what it is that you've done. You're burned up. It's over. When you fall into the arms of this harlot, it's over for you. So I suspect that the potential for adultery was a capital crime, bear in mind. And I suspect that the potential of committing a capital crime, however rarely it may have been actually enforced, was at least on people's mind. There was a certain danger attached, a certain risk in committing adultery. But Solomon's point is, it won't matter. You're going to be ruined. So, I think this chapter is linked together. And I think it's linked together by four different ideas. Or one, let me put it this way, four different examples of one theme. And the theme of this chapter is coming to complete ruin. And he tells him, if you want, you need to avoid the practice of surety, which is the improvident living by pledging your name, wealth, labor, and your future to others. You could come to ruin because you've done those things. You need to avoid coming to ruin through being indolent or being a sluggard. You need to avoid coming to ruin by a malicious hatred of your neighbor, because God detests this. He hates it. And you need to avoid coming to complete ruin through adultery. You need to avoid the strange married woman, for adultery will burn you without mercy. So I think this is a chapter of warnings. It has some examples of life attached to it, the commandments, the reproofs. And he seems to only attach those, or only give that instruction in the section on sexual temptations, which I think goes to show how what kind of relative priority that Solomon sees. But it's a very picturesque chapter of grave, grave warnings, literally grave warnings. You're going to come to ruin, you're going to be brought to nothing, and she's going to burn you, and it's over. Also, nobody will have pity on you. You commit adultery. And everything that you do is going to be, all of these are examples of people who are devoid of instruction. The wise see it. The rest, they just look at it and say, devoid. So, that was quick, but I didn't want to take several weeks in this chapter. We could have, but comments or questions or observations?
Dave, of course, I always enjoy the metaphor of the indolent saying there's a lion in the streets. Maybe, it's hard to, it's a little hard for me to know how maybe it wasn't so ridiculous. I guess that's what I tend to say, not the way we would say it. But it seems to me that often people who are even a little indolent can find good excuses not to, say, apply for a job or, take the next step. Just because, there could be, I might not, I've heard that, there's might not be a good boss at that job.
Right.
Or I've heard that, they don't always do something, get goods from China. I mean, you come up with some kind of excuse, and I'd say probably in my life I've heard those kind of things quite often.
I think the excuse factory is endless.
Yeah.
It's endless. And they have more imagination than you do. Yeah, I think you're right. Any other comments?
I'm kind of curious, or what was interesting was the surety. He seems to go back and forth between a friend and a stranger.
Right.
And he made no distinction.
That's right.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Don't let your friend prevail upon you through friendship, and don't be foolish and reckless when a stranger comes, because it's too good to pass up. It's too good to be. You don't want to miss out, which is still a sales tactic today. Any other comments or questions?
Well, I'm just here to tell you that driving in on Highway 51 today, there were a lot of lions on the street.
Well, glad you made it. Were any of them fierce lions?